Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 195. How do you get yourself unstuck when facing a programming problem? How do you develop a positive developer mindset while learning Python? This week on the show, Bob Belderboss from PyBytes is here to talk about learning Python and building healthy developer habits. Bob created the PyBytes learning platform with his friend Julian Sequeira. They initially focused on exercises and coding challenges to motivate new Python students. As they grew their community, they created a podcast and moved into coaching. They noticed that most new developers share common struggles of tutorial paralysis, imposter syndrome, and motivation. Bob discusses techniques for developing a positive mindset, overcoming coding blocks, and delivering projects. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Bob, welcome to the show.
Hey, Christopher. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here. How are you doing?
Good. I'm excited to talk to you. We have been having this interesting back and forth since before the beginning of the year, and I'm intrigued to learn about PyBytes. I'm intrigued to learn about, you know, how your podcast is going, and we're really here to focus on learning and learning Python and tips and tricks for helping people get into what you guys like to call sort of a mindset for learning, which I'm fascinated to learn about what that is. And maybe we start with, tell me about PyBytes and how you guys started that with you and Julian, right?
Yes, it's me and Julian, and now we also have a team. But cool. Back in the day, that was not the case. this was literally Julian and myself. You know, we're best friends as well, and we were early on the Tim Ferriss 4-hour work week, and we were always geeking out on doing something on the side, starting a business. And we're also into tech and programming, because Julian was working in the data center and he's a hardware guy originally, and I was already doing software development. And yeah, over the Christmas of 2016, we decided, let's do something more serious with Python, because he was getting into it.
Okay.
Fairly newbie, and I was already coding in it, and I just wanted to get much better. And we started a tech blog, like one in a gazillion, right?
Sure, sure.
But we just wanted to have an outlet to, you know, start teaching, start document, not even teaching, but really like document our learning.
Yeah, which is kind of a cool way of learning, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
Yeah. And that actually led to a lot of things. But right from the start, we started to write articles, and pretty soon we came with the concept of code challenges, because we kind of found that you know, all the materials, it was quite passive, right? And how we really learned was by building projects and scripts. So yeah, we would go on the blog, and on Monday we would have a code challenge, and by Friday we would have the solution, and then we would try to involve people and have them share their solutions and really learn that way.
Yeah.
And yeah, that kind of became our niche of being practical, of always do this by building and challenge. And from there on, we did 100 Days of Code, and we got in touch with Michael Kennedy, which of course you know.
Oh yeah, I have him on the show.
Yeah, I got on his show after a year or so, and then we built out a couple of 100 Days courses with him as well. We built our coding platform, which now hosts like 400 exercises. And starting 2020, we went into one-to-one coaching because we wanted to help people in a more effective way. And that turned out to be coaching. Yeah.
I have a question on the coding challenge. I think that's a powerful way to build a community, like sort of to almost bootstrap it, because I think people are eager to share their solutions, number one. Uh-huh. Number two, it's like such a positive environment as far as the commentary. I guess you got to foster that a little bit, but I wonder about that. Do you feel that's what kind of happened with you guys? Like that it helped really foster and kind of bootstrap this community around what you were doing?
Yeah, I think the whole code challenge and involving people and comparing solution, that was really, as you said, bootstrapping the community, which we then, I think after 6 months, we launched our Slack and we got up to 3,000 people over the years. But recently we ditched the Slack in favor of Circle because Circle is more like a forum and it has retention, and Slack kind of felt more like a work tool.
Circle, is that something you host yourself or is that a service again?
That's funny. It's people think that because one of the nice features is that Circle makes it look like your own instance, like you have your logo and it feels very Pybyte style.
Oh, okay.
But no, it's a solution out there and you just pay for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
So yeah, I think that whole code challenge concept really, and also the 100 days of code, because that's also often done in community sense that people do that together, they hold each other accountable, share solutions. So I think that was instrumental. Yeah.
That's awesome. When did you start your podcast and why did you start it?
Great question. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago. I think if we go by one episode a week, it's 3 years because we just passed 150. Yeah. So 3 years and 2 months, I guess. It was at the end of some year. So that must have been at the end of 2020 then. Yeah. Yeah.
What was the reasoning for starting that?
Yeah, that was funny. We almost put it on hold again. And I think it was Jason, buddy or our community, who really at a PyCon challenges. But I think he just made a random comment like, why don't you guys have a podcast? Like, it's the obvious thing to have or do, sure. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, and we like teaching, and we had already done a couple of courses at that point. So we were kind of used to getting on video and explain things. Yeah, but it's kind of fun. Now it seems so obvious, but back then somebody had to push us and now we're doing it.
That's funny. Yes, I'm the reverse. I'm the one who walked up to Dan and said, why don't we have a podcast while I was working at Real Python? And it was like more like, do you want to do it? And I was like, sure.
Yeah, you guys also had a relatively late, right, in the game.
Yeah, yeah. Only 4 years now. It'll be 4 years shortly.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're like in one, oh, this would be like 195 or something like that episode.
Yeah.
94, 95, yeah. So it's...
Great work. It's... enjoy it. Yeah.
I enjoy doing it. It's fun to meet people and talk to people and learn new things. I won't say that it hasn't had its challenges, and definitely across the pandemic has been one of the larger challenges of finding people that are ready and wanting to share and so forth. So we kind of split it up. We do these separate episodes that are more newsy and more about articles and about teaching. And David Amos was my other host early, and then now Christopher Trudeau, who I've got a good rapport with, which has been fun.
Nice.
Yeah. The reason I mentioned the podcast partly was because a common topic that I see almost sort of tagged on the end of the titles of a lot of them is mindset.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm intrigued by that. Like, number one, you know, what is your feeling as to what is a coding mindset? And then how does that relate to those particular Pybyte episodes?
Yeah, so we actually learned that through the coaching, right? That people often come to us for the Python and stay for the mindset and community.
Sure.
And then when we started working with people, we just got bigger insight into what people, what really drives them and where they get stuck. And we learned that, you know, some of the biggest pains are tutorial paralysis, imposter syndrome, perfectionism, shiny new object syndrome, lack of persistence, right? And
yeah.
And then we did the math and it's like, oh, these are all mindset things. Like, usually people do figure out the tech sooner or later, but it's more like that consistency and pushing through and putting your work out there and maybe being able to be vulnerable or even
yeah,
subject yourself to a code review or apply for that job. And yeah, there's a lot of psychology involved in that and a lot of fear. And yeah, that's what became one of the main things we help people with. I mean, we do have a lot of Python content. We're definitely technical, but it's often the mindset that completes the whole path that people need to succeed.
Yeah. I think about someone signing up or literally being put into a school in whatever context that is, and the requirements of this is on the calendar, I'm required to be here for whatever reason, or I'm paying to be here. And it's a very different thing as a person who maybe is coming from a different language or is trying to pick up Python or a language from scratch in so what would be, you know, maybe quote unquote spare time. And the requirement for something like a mindset, there's so many of these additional obstacles that kind of get in the way. Is that something, do you feel that, does that map to what you're talking about?
Yeah, I also think that the programming inherently is just complex, right? Like,
yeah,
at a certain point, you hit a level that you can kind of confidently write code and you know the tools, but it takes a long time to get there, right? When I started to code back in 05, 06, and sometimes I forget this, right? That I felt pretty dumb and I would make a lot of mistakes and I couldn't follow the tutorials and I ran into all kinds of side issues that were not related to the tutorial. And yeah, it took a lot of persistence to get over that phase and to get to a certain level that you kind of are confident and can manage, right? But I'm not sure if that was the key of your question, sorry.
No, it's close. I wonder if you had the experience of learning Python outside of a school or university type of context, and if that's partly what helped you start to think about this mindset stuff.
Also, like not having an initial tech background and getting into Python, right?
Yeah, potentially. Is that your story?
Yeah, totally. I studied business economics back in Holland, or finance.
Yeah.
So it did have to do with numbers and calculations, but I was using Excel for years, right?
So sure.
I guess that's a form of programming.
Yeah.
And my first foray was into VBA scripting. So it was some, you know, but it's not like your CS degree and algorithms, that kind of stuff I didn't get from the uni or where I studied, right? So I did have to learn it myself and with mentors and with resources. Luckily, so when I moved to Spain in 04, I had to find a job, obviously, to stay,
right? Yeah.
to pass the proof of concept phase. And I landed a support job for Unix servers, right? And I think that initial exposure to the command line and Unix, that definitely boosted my coding skills and just how you think about machines and systems. And so that did help. But yeah, it was definitely a transition. Yeah.
Was that an introduction to Python then there in like ways to make that job easier?
That came later. So it was shell scripting. And then I saw a niche in web development to build tools on the job. And I got into MySQL and PHP and just web design and stuff. And then Perl, and that got a mess. And then shopped around, found Python, and life was beautiful after. Even after, yeah.
Yeah. Did you have experience in teaching before all of this?
Good question. Not really. Like, I did enjoy in every job sharing knowledge and yeah, teaching in a sense, but
it
never really crossed my mind that I would be doing this almost full time, right?
And, no. yeah. Yeah. Is I don't know if you feel comfortable speaking for Julian, but does he have a teaching background too?
I don't think he has, but I think he's a great communicator. So that really helps him, right? And he has a lot of empathy and he's just really good with people, right? So he can just sense where somebody is at and then, you know, give proper guidance. So I think
that's a huge part.
He might not have a teaching background because he was doing server admin and swapping server components and stuff. And that's how we connected at back in Sun Microsystems. But yeah, teaching is a lot of communication, right? So
it comes in so many forms. And obviously, you find across these different things that you've done. And you're right. It's like this huge, I don't know, it's like an elevated form of communication in a way. You know, you need to find someone who's willing to learn and share what you what you're finding, but I've been passionate about it my whole life. Like, I just love sharing, you know, the things that I've learned how to do and making sure people, you know, understand things. And
that's beautiful, right? When you see that light bulb moment, yeah. Like, ah, now I get it, right? You can make it more accessible, right?
Yeah, I got into it probably through consulting. I was working at a music store and people would come in, and I love gadgets and love technology and would learn how to use these very advanced like synthesizers and sequencers and other tools from their front panel. And every model was like learning this, you know, math tricks, you know, and I liked sharing that. And so that was really fun. And the thing that was the light bulb moment for that was these musicians had bought very expensive equipment and they weren't able to make music, and they needed that help to get over just that little point. And so that was like that light bulb moment where they're like, ah, yes, finally I can do, you know, I can create stuff with all the stuff I've bought. And I feel like that's same with Python, like cracking that initial set of things. Like, what are the hurdles that are making somebody get there so they can actually, ah, I can finally, you know, build something and create something.
You unlock them, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you have a mindset tag on your podcast episode, what does that mean?
Yeah, it means that we talk a lot of mindset. So it's like going back to what people really struggle with, we found the mindset.
Yeah.
And we also found, okay, so we do YouTube videos. Well, that came a bit later, but that's usually Python. We write articles, that's Python. We have exercises, those are Python. We have a lot of little tips, practical snippets, that's Python. Where can we vent and discuss mindsets? Well, audio, perfect.
Yeah, yeah. Right?
So it does also, it goes well with the channel, with the format. Yeah, every time we get feedback on the podcast, people do appreciate the guests and the Python, but what we most hear is like the mindset, right? Like,
yeah.
And even to the extent that somebody was saying this week, like, thanks to listening to your podcast, now I'm getting over that perfectionism. I'm more comfortable shipping code, taking decisions, right? So yeah, it's nice to hear that the podcast can have that impact. And yeah, I think again the audio goes well with mindset.
Yeah, so you'll have like a guest like Will McGugan and ask him about his tools and stuff like that, but then ask him like a set of questions that are geared toward the mindset stuff at the end or something?
Yeah, I always announce the mindset question, like if I don't ask it, Julian will slap me in the face. But I'm also myself genuinely interested in that side, of course. But yeah, so you get a guest on, we talk a lot about the person's work. And so in case of Will, of course, Rich and Textualize. But yeah, inevitably we always pivot like, hey, seems you're so knowledgeable, which he is, right? And and you make those amazing libraries. How come? How do you get there?
Yeah, right?
How
do you deal with all those barriers? Yeah.
Yeah. How do you deal with complexity? How do you design? Or even like, have you felt about ever giving up programming?
Yeah,
because that's also a side you don't often hear about, right? Like you see those repos and you see what these people do, and it seems very not something that you can ever reach, and you know,
yeah
not to take away from these people because they're some brilliant programmers, but often when you really distill the mindset, they have techniques, they have ways to break the complexity into simpler steps.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's fascinating to kind of reverse engineer not only the Python, but also like what's going on with the mindset, right? How do you get to that level?
That's cool. Yeah, I like that idea, and I think it's a neat way to kind of focus back, as opposed to like, you know, people's background, which is a common thing that you hear on podcasts. You know, what are they doing now to deal with, you know, keeping going and so forth, which is, I think, such a common struggle for all of us. Just like, how can I keep it going and keep things happening? And especially somebody who's as prolific as the type of guests that we have.
Yeah. Yeah.
This week, I want to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course, and it's related to the topic we cover this week. The course is designed to help you take your skills to the next level by building projects, and it's titled Grow Your Python Portfolio with 13 Intermediate Project Ideas. This course is based on a Real Python article by Habib Chopadju, and your course instructor will be Darren Jones, and he takes you through why it's important to start building projects. What are the major platforms that you can build your projects on? What are some of the important details for building command line, web, and graphical user interfaces? Darren shares 13 project ideas that you can start to work on. Plus, he includes helpful tips for researching and customizing the projects. I think it's a worthy investment of your time to move beyond reading tutorials to creating projects you can share with others and demonstrate your knowledge. And like most of the video courses on Real Python, the course is broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, you get additional resources and code examples for the techniques shown. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the enhanced search tool on realpython.com. So one of the things that we wanted to talk about is tips. It's interesting because I feel that's how I met Dan the first through audio, hearing him go on and talk about his book, Python Tricks. And
yeah,
I wonder, is that kind of where you guys started a little bit, in the sense that PyBytes has some of that content, but then also you moved into challenges. Mm-hmm. Are you a fan of sharing tips and tricks?
Oh yeah, I'm big on sharing tips and tricks. I do that a lot on Twitter. That's called X now, and LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And we wrote a tips book, I think it was back in 2020, right? Which had 250 tips. I think we just over the years started collecting them from the platform and from our articles and from our continuous study. Because with Python, right, it's so simple to get into, but it's also very profound, in the sense that the whole thing about Pythonic or idiomatic code is learnable, and it comes often down to knowing the standard library better and using more of the built-ins. And
yeah,
in the Zen, it says like there's one obvious way to do things, and sometimes that's not true because yes, there are multiple ways. See packaging.
Yeah.
But many times there are, like f-strings, right? Like you should probably always use f-strings. And so we were, going back to that teaching, we were really passionate about, yeah, showing the right way to do it and how you can use Python. Because if you use Python in its most idiomatic way, it's really beautiful.
Yeah.
How you can write code, right? So I think that's one of the rationales with these tips. Like these little snippets, also people are very busy, make it consumable, heavy on the code. Yeah.
I think it's one of the telltale, like, I don't know if I'm a fan of the term code smell. Mm-hmm. Like, again, I'm not in that school of thought, and maybe it's partly
Kent Beck, right?
Yeah, and I have a very different background and so forth. And so, like, it, I don't know, feels like an insult in some ways, because I think, like, you know, hey, if code works, it works, and so forth. And, you know, heading back to the perfectionism thing. But one of the things that I can agree with is you can tell someone who is not a native Python coder pretty quickly by looking at their code. Mm-hmm. Or maybe the language that they came from.
Yeah.
When I took my first Python test to get a job, I definitely was not creating for loops in a proper way. Mm. I was definitely doing them in a JavaScript way, because that was the most recent language I had learned,
right,
before I tried to learn Python. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, the minute I started looking articles and digging in, learning more Python, I'm like, oh man, there's this thing, it's called an iterable. Right. You can let it do its work. Are there things that you see in people's code that you feel like tips and tricks that can help them become more Pythonic, like a couple that we can share?
Good question. So yeah, the looping, people coming from C or Java, sometimes they use range and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then counters, manual index. And even if you don't use range, but you manually count, you know, the loops, then you really should be using enumerate. So it often comes down to missing one or more built-ins, right? Which make the job much nicer. But also the standard library, people then sometimes miss really good stuff you can do with iter tools or func tools.
Yeah. Those are some of my favorite libraries, yeah.
Yeah, or even simple stuff like maybe hard coding the alphabet when you can use a string module that has ready-made constants in there. So stuff like that. And that usually comes down not knowing enough about standard library or the built-ins.
Is there a good approach for learning the standard library? Like, do you think there's a good technique for how to approach consuming something like that?
Yeah, so definitely not kind of a doc's book work that you want to read A to Z.
Yeah.
So what people appreciate a lot are the bytes, because then they just organically get exposed to bits of the standard library as they solve problems, which is a more fun way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it also just takes writing a lot of code and getting code reviewed and getting feedback like, hey, maybe you can do this better, more efficient.
Have you seen this tool?
Yeah, and that's also what I like about the tips. And what people appreciate about me posting so many tips is that now they get all these little nuggets, right? And they might not use it in the moment, but as they're like small pieces, they can bookmark them, they can save the code and try it later. So that's a quick and efficient way for them to learn without getting in tutorial paralysis.
Yeah. I find that going back and doing, I'm sure we'll talk about projects often, but like digging in and trying to create some code and so forth. I think it's fantastic if you have that opportunity to have a code review and or a forum to do it in. I find that going back and looking at either the docs, you know, from, you know, docs.python or what have you, or one thing I experienced recently is I've had a bunch of conversations about abstract syntax trees and these other kinds of things that happen to do with the grammar of Python. And that's an interesting read. It's actually pretty quick compared to like reading all the docs that are involved. It's like, well, what makes all the different, you know, grammatical things that happen inside of Python? That's a common thing for me as a learner or a teacher, is looking at something foreign and go, what does that do?
Yeah.
And why is that being used in other people's code and so forth? And I've said this about decorators multiple times, or other things, or type hints were a big one for me too. Like, what is that stuff? What is it doing? Again, coming from other languages and looking at it.
I like that approach, like more going vertical, drilling down into a specific problem and then go really deep into the stack or the technologies that happen to be involved, instead of like, today I'm going to start up on iterators for the sake of iterators, right? And then it's more a theoretical approach and boring.
Yeah.
No, solve a practical problem, and then inevitably you're going to have a couple of requirements or things you're going to look in, and then really studying them.
Yeah.
Because then, and that's maybe goes a little bit into the project-based learning, right? Then it's more interesting because now you're studying these technologies to achieve something, right? So you will be more motivated. It will be more contextual, therefore more interesting. So you will be more motivated.
That makes me think of two things. One is sort of an idea for a format with that, and maybe we'll both use it or not. But as you provide a challenge, to have unlockable hints that are below it that you can use, that says, so here's this thing that you should accomplish, and people could just go and do it. And if they want to, they could say, okay, give me a hint. I'm still beginning there. And it's like, well, maybe go look at the iter tools module, you know, or hey, go look at this, like have these kind of like levels of things that could kind of spur that spontaneous study and research and so forth. And the other is just the idea of how challenges sort of gamify the whole thing.
Yeah.
People like to complete things and get a score or whatever, or a completion.
That's huge.
Yeah.
We do both things on the platform. The hints, that's a miss that we didn't really implement. We were pretty nasty in that we have a view solution button, and then when somebody clicks it, they get penalized in the points. I kind of regret that feature a little bit, but
okay,
because it's so recoverable. And the hints, that's a great idea, right? If you can make that exposure like more granular, that's interesting.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it also has led to people really try harder, because it's like either you pass the exercise or not. And yeah, people kind of know that clicking the solution will penalize them. So they really, really try really, really hard, up until dozens or maybe even 100 submit sometimes. It's really crazy.
Yeah.
But then the gamification, I was going through Miguel Grinberg's Flash tutorial like years ago.
Sure. Yeah, I did that one.
I'm not sure I mentioned this. I think how I learned that, or kind of made that sticky, was that I would take his code and then extend it and build something on top of it. And that happened to be a gamification thing, I think, because it was basically a blogging Flask app, right? So I would build a gamification thing.
Yeah, very much so. It was like a micro Twitter. Yeah.
Yeah, the more people would post, the more points they got. And Yeah, kind of accidentally, that became the blueprint for gamification on our platform, because now when they solve these exercises, they earn points, and the points lead to a whole skill of ninja belts.
Oh, okay.
And that has people going wild. Like, that gamification is really, really motivating for people, like, to keep solving exercises and hit that next ranking, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It scratches something.
Yeah, definitely.
That's cool. Yeah. You have this note here about, like, not only Python tips, but the idea of content sharing. Uh-huh. What do you mean by that?
So content sharing means, yeah, what does it mean? We had a blog since the early days, so that's a form of sharing.
Yeah.
But I think I also alluded to getting out there, going on social media and post on LinkedIn and Twitter, and yeah, really teaching not only one-to-one or by written content, but actively sharing on social media as well.
So I guess that's related to like how you began the whole thing of writing, I'm not sure if to call them blog posts or not, but basically these longer form things about Python. It's interesting because social media has taken over this idea of the micro version of that, right? Microblogging or whatever.
Yeah.
Is the engagement different on those two things?
On Twitter versus blog?
Yeah, in the sense the stuff that works in those two different places that you seem to get responses to those different things.
Yeah, we did turn off comments on the blog, so we don't really have a discussion there.
Okay.
So yeah, social media is great for people to comment and have a discussion about the content, but also to kind of gate, especially Twitter is useful for that. When you ask, so for research, right? Like, what kind of do you want to see? What is your take on? Usually gets a lot of responses, and that can then drive a bit your decision what to produce content on. Because that's the other thing, right? Like, what to produce content on, right? We have ideas, but usually
yes.
When you talk with people, they actually want something totally different, right? So yeah, I think one thing with content sharing is worth noting is that you need to be in touch with your audience. You have your own struggles with coding that usually is indicative, but yeah, there's so many other minds thinking about programming and experiencing it that it's good to be in touch and really make sure you do it for them, right? And yeah, write the content that needs to be written or produced.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder about, recent days, not to bring this to a downer, but, Twitter has changed dramatically. And I wonder if that has affected the community and the engagement that you get there. And have you done experiments in other places? I think you already mentioned LinkedIn. Have you tried some of these other, Blue Sky, Mastodon, Threads, I guess? I don't know if there's probably other ones I'm missing. But
Blue Sky is the first time I hear about. Mastodon, I joined.
Okay.
But I didn't give it enough attention. Probably deserves because I did see a blog post by Adam Johnson that more people are moving to Mastodon.
Definitely developers in the quote unquote, I don't want to call them the community, but I don't know what else to call them. The people that I harvest for guests, if you will, to like look for guests and things like that and what they're talking about. And some of those type of people definitely moved in that direction and like turned off their Twitter.
Yeah.
But it's not all of them. And it's definitely not the type of people that were doing engaging back and forth kind of conversations like you guys do. It's more like people like Brett Cannon, who's asking his core followers, like, is this a good idea? And so forth. He's more interested in like this deeper bench of core developers and things like that, which is kind of intriguing to me.
Yeah.
But I wonder about that. Has that changed for you on Twitter?
It didn't change that much for me. No, I got still get followers, still get good interaction on my posts.
Okay.
Not too toxic, as a lot of people warn about.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's good.
My change. You never know with X where it's going.
Well, there's always stuff happening on the other side that you don't
never
see,
know the algorithm. Yeah. Can change tomorrow. And that's maybe also a good point, because sometimes people ask, like, I'm new to this whole thing. I want to share content. Should I start with a blog or should I start social media? That's a fair question, right? Because I think social media might have a lower entry barrier because you don't have to launch a blog and you can probably do shorter content.
Right.
But just keep in mind that content, or you back it up or it's not yours, right? And nor do you know the algorithm.
Right.
Whereas a blog, still indexed by Google, you own it. So I would turn still more to the old school blogs and you know, again, you own it, it's yours. Yeah. Probably going to put more effort into it, make it more in long form, and then you can still share it on social media, right?
So right. It's still a way to, funnel people one direction or the other,
It's
good. What are things that you've learned across this progress of teaching and helping people with these challenges? What have you learned about writing cleaner code?
I have a passion for clean code already from before PyBytes, because I think it was in 2016, so half a year before starting PyBytes, that I was studying with the SIG software improvement group.
Okay.
And they have this building maintainable software book and certificate, which I did. So I was definitely passionate about that subject already.
Okay.
I think with PyBytes, it's just crystallized in that, we learned way more Python and way more things how to write better Python.
Sure.
And we have worked with hundreds of people. So we have done hundreds, if not thousands, of code reviews. So we kind of see what people are doing and where they can improve. But also I think that the whole clean code thing, not saying it's simple, but usually you can kind of narrow down in a couple of rules, right? Like, and I can give you some examples.
Sure.
Like, for example, the refactoring book by Martin Fowler has a catalog of refactorings, and it's pretty exhaustive, right? So there's only so many more things to learn. So for example, right, what I think clean code comes down to is managing complexity, right? So,
okay,
right, more functions, smaller functions, have functions do one thing, use classes if it makes sense, but probably I wouldn't start with classes when I start a project. So this is all about managing, keeping it simple, right? And the Zen of Python is, of course, exemplary of this.
Okay.
Then there are things like global scope being a bit dangerous. So using proper encapsulation when you can. There are things like magic numbers. You can break out into constants. But then there are common things I highlight in code reviews, right? Maybe an exception block is very wide. So then I ask, like, well, are all these lines in the try and except really going to trigger that exception? Maybe you should narrow the try except a bit more, right?
Okay.
There's things about using the right data structures. If you go through a list, it might be slow. If you do lookups in sets and dictionaries, you get 0-1 performance, stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Another one of my favorites is long if, elif, 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 else. It's cleaner to use a dictionary, the dispatch pattern.
Okay.
So those are common things. But I think that list is also pretty exhausted, limited. And there are things like using your linters, so automating more, right? So your flake 8, black or rough, and then hooking it up in pre-commit to automate that maintenance as much as possible.
I had some guests on to talk about code reviews. And one of the things I wondered about was advice on how to keep that process positive. Mm-hmm. And is that something that you have experienced, like having to think about how to do that?
In the code review setting, like the feedback, keep that positive and stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point, because I think you want to be empathical with that, because for some people, it's kind of takes guts to even do a code review, and people can get pretty sensitive about their code, and right, so
sure,
you want to make sure you don't affect their confidence, right? And especially in a coaching setting, right, where people are learning and can be rough, right? Yes, so you definitely highlight things that can be better, but I think you should also applaud things that are well done, right? It's often we always comment on the things that should be changed, but also always try to applaud when they actually did something clever, or
Yeah.
Oh, cool that you thought about this. Or, hey, this is really clean. Good that you did the doc strings there, or something like that, right? So communication, right? Yeah.
I feel like some people will take feedback in different ways. There's definitely different personalities. You mentioned the empathy part of it. And I think about, there are people that are going to want you to be direct and not sugarcoat things. And maybe will feel offended. And again, that might be their cultural or personal background. And then there are other people where you can kind of see like they're just crazy, big eye, nervous, and wondering like, okay, how can I do this? And that's where you might, you know, approach it differently. One of the techniques I learned, I worked for Apple for a little while as a trainer with them, is this idea of asking permission.
Okay.
Are you comfortable with me giving you really direct feedback about something, or would you prefer me to do it, you know, a different way, or whatever, something like that? I don't know. I've never tried it in this circumstance, but it made me think about that. What you were just saying,
yeah.
So one of the things that I'm intrigued by is thinking about how we lead this from, like, say, a challenge, and is that something that then you have another level of that where you're like, okay. Now we're going to build a project. And is that something that you guys do on your platform?
The platform is pure exercises, Python specific. And usually you complete one or more functions that are then tested against a set of PyTest. It's great for, really boosting your Python skills. But if you want to build a project end-to-end, there's way more involved in that, right? That's now you have to work with modules and packages, and you have to structure your code. And the clean code aspect we spoke about, and you want to add testing, and you want to refactor. So yeah, that's where the projects come into place. And that's what we do with the coaching.
Okay.
So bootcamps usually put people in classrooms, and they build all the same thing. We didn't really like that idea, so we made it fully customized. So people come with us with their ideas, and basically they can build almost anything they want, as long as it involves Python. So it's more fun. They're going to be more motivated, and yeah, they will end up with projects that they should be proud about, and can really showcase on their portfolio.
Yeah, I think that's a big thing. I think about that in other learning contexts. I mentioned music a lot, but I feel that is a huge barrier for someone learning piano, that often the people creating the platform will just piggyback on this entire history of public domain music and assume that is great and that's what people want to learn. But in my own personal experience, I don't necessarily want to play those simple public domain songs for friends and family. I would rather play songs that they're interested in, or, you know, pop music or whatever. And, you know, of course, there's like this barrier there, which I think is interesting. And I feel the same way about projects, that if I'm being brought into something and we're building a project that I don't even know if I would want to show it to somebody else. It's just this sort of generic project, whereas I'm excited about this thing. This is my idea or my take on this idea, and I have this passion for it and I want to share it with. Is that something you feel like was a part of the equation?
Yeah, that makes all the difference. And we experienced this firsthand, right, with building PyBytes. But me specifically, when I was building the coding platform, so I wanted to learn Django.
Yeah.
And also I had to figure, so we wanted to build a coding platform. So this whole code challenge thing started with GitHub and pull request, and that was the flow, right? And so the initial aim was to automate that process, right? To make it easier for people to do their pull request on the fork of the challenges repo.
Okay.
And that's why we built a platform. But then I'm not sure where that happened, but all of a sudden we thought like, would it actually be cool if people can solve exercises in the browser?
Yeah.
So yeah, and then I start to look at options, but you know, there were like JavaScript-based solutions which were a bit limited in the sense that they didn't support the whole standard library, let alone PyPI packages. And we wanted to have exercises on all kinds of stuff, right? And then I was forced to look at, okay, if I cannot run the code in the browser, can I run it somewhere in the cloud? And then I stumbled upon AWS Gateway API and AWS Lambda. And then we managed to build Lambda functions that will... So the Lambda, not to get too technical, but basically somebody submits code on our platform. I will get to the point why I'm detailing this in a sec. But
that's okay.
So they call the Lambda function. The Lambda function calls back to the API, grabs the submitted code plus the PyTest, and then in the cloud it runs the PyTest against the submitted code, and then it's a pass or fail. And that gets communicated back, and that's what the user then sees in the browser. So that's a pretty complex system. But that was my obsession that had to be built, right? So that became my deliberate practice Django project. But also, like, we want
to... Yeah, you're learning a ton.
Yeah, we also want to build this out as a SaaS product for PyBytes. And I was obsessed. I was coding till 6 in the morning. Not very healthy. It's it was the time of my life, temporarily. But yeah, that was so much deliberate practice and so complex. And I think that kind of cemented the belief, like, yeah, to really learn this, you need to build bigger stuff and better be something you care about to really have that motivation. And that really worked.
Yeah, I think about that often, just like the idea of like finding ways that people can customize the project if you're going to share a project to make it their own, to make it be something that they're much more interested in sharing with other people. And, you know, hey, check out this cool thing I built. I'm interested in video games, but a lot of people are not. And so building a game is something that I know I could share with this subset of people.
And this can be anything, right? This can be an idea that you want to turn into a business, but it could also be an open source project.
Yeah, there's so much to learn that.
Right. Or it could, sometimes people struggle to come up with ideas, but then just say, like, see something that you find boring, that takes you a lot of time, and try to automate it. Right. And like the book, Automate the Boring Stuff. And then,
absolutely.
Or look around at family and friends. Do you see somebody with a need? And maybe you can build something for them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's my favorite thing to do. I love building tools that I know that someone's going to use, and making sure to ask the questions and get the feedback from the person you're building it for, if it's not some kind of surprise project.
That changes everything, right?
Yeah, it does. And you learn so much about constraints, and you learn so much about being empathetic as a programmer also, right. Not just as a teacher of like, well, who is the end user, being empathetic for them and like seeing like, well, how are they going to use this? Is this comfortable? Is this just an easy solution for me?
Yeah, because if you don't do that and you don't put yourself in that situation, then you're not getting the whole scope of what software development is about, because it is actually a lot about working with users and their requirements that are always changing, and communication and empathy. It's not only about the code, right?
Yeah, totally. What are some of the tips that you have for helping people when they do get stuck, and kind of going back to the mindset thing, what are techniques and things that you found that help in that situation?
I have a list.
All right, great.
So sometimes you just need to walk away, right? I've spent way too much time just banging my head against the wall or the keyboard, and sometimes you're just stuck, right? And as much time as you keep spending, it's just not there.
Yeah.
But then if you go out, even for a quick walk or do something else, it's I think it's a Diffused Mind, Mind for Numbers book. It keeps working on that problem subconsciously. It's pretty fascinating how that works. I don't know how it works, but
it's hard to turn it off, I think.
But it's working at another level, and then you come back and you're also refreshed, and then you look differently at the problem. And sometimes you just have the solution like that, right? So, and that's very insidious, because it's I've been the first one to just, because that's the. It's both a strength and a weakness of the programmer, that we're very tenacious, right? Like I was saying, like coding till 6 in the morning, not being able to stop. It's like an addiction almost,
yeah.
Right? Which is good, because you will need a lot of hours of deliberate practice. But when you're stuck, it's also your worst enemy, and then you need to sometimes stop. Code reviewing, that was a major jumping point for me, having coded for years in a silo mostly. And then being part of a more experienced team with developers that had been doing it for many years, and then getting that constructive feedback was pretty important. So the more code reviews you can do on both sides, actually.
Yeah.
Because from the if you submit one, you're going to actually see gaps in your code you couldn't see before, because you were not, you know, showing your code to anybody. And on the other side, it's a great way to mentor and teach, right?
That's such a thing of like being comfortable to do that, even, you know, to like even show other people your code. I mean, I think it leads to our next question.
Okay. Then let's talk about that in a bit, because that's actually a big thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But even rubber duck debugging, if you just tell your problem to the rubber duck, even if it's not really rubber duck, whatever, but just laying out the problem for yourself can really help.
Yeah, yeah.
I will go a bit faster. Seek a supporters community.
Yeah.
Again, not getting caught up in your silo. Join a supportive community. We have one, of course. I think you have one.
Yeah, yeah.
People connect, and that's really helpful. Break down things into smaller steps. Sometimes if you're stuck, it means that you're either too high abstraction or too high complexity, and then you still need to break it down further, and that can help. So maybe you can solve a sub-problem, which then leads to solving the bigger problem. And I think efficiently debugging, or just debugging overall. I think I was using print a lot, and print helps in a lot of cases, but there was a moment that, and I think that was in the more experienced team, that somebody hinted at, like, why don't you put a breakpoint? And that was a pivotal moment, that side comment, because since then I've been using the debugger. And
yeah,
I mean, because debugging is maybe a bit of a misnomer, like debug, like we're solving bugs, but actually it's useful for everything, right? It's useful to when you write your tests, when you want to just inspect. It's like you have this timeout in your code, and that's very powerful. So
it's like doing like a slow motion review of your whole code flow.
It's amazing.
It's like you get to ride it like an amusement park ride as it goes through the thing. You can see what variables are active right now, what's happening, the scope of different things. You just you're traveling through it.
It's like the Matrix. You know, when it slows the time, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, bullet time.
Yeah. So exactly. Would it help me get stuck? I do think so, because thanks to using the debugger more, I'm just more inspecting the objects in real time. And I think that really helps. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So 5 tips. Yeah.
That's good. That's awesome. Yeah. And so the other one that's related to this idea of, like, I don't know if I want to show my code to other people, is this idea of related to imposter syndrome, which, you know, a lot of developers deal with, and a lot of people deal with in you know, across their life, and wonder about that. And what are things that you've found that help people work through that?
Yeah, it's another pretty serious deal. I definitely had it. I think we all still have it. Every time you hit a new level, you get it. It's like this unwelcome enemy that's always recurring, coming back, you know?
Yeah. On your shoulder, yeah.
But a few things. I think, first of all, just acknowledging that it exists, that you have it, and that it's okay. That even very experienced people have it. I think Guido von Rossum, there's a tweet somewhere that, you know, he acknowledged it. I think people like Sebastian Ramirez, right, creator of Fast API, he was at some point talking about it on Twitter. And, you know, like, at that level, we all have it. And that's okay. Because there's that article, was it by Zapier? Like, real imposters don't have imposter syndrome. So,
yeah. It's the psychopath test.
Yeah.
If you've ever questioned that you have this thing.
Yeah. So if you wouldn't have it, maybe then you would be an imposter or something like that, right? It's kind of mind-blowing. But yeah, acknowledge it's there, and that's okay. It's part of growth, right? I think a lot of it comes also from comparing to others. So if you look at mentioned names that have these gigantic libraries, yeah, of course you feel like an imposter when doing even coding.
Yeah.
But, you know, recognize that, you know, they are open source developers, right? They might not be financial app developers, right? Everybody lives in their niche, and everybody has different talents. So I think good advice is to compare yourself to your yesterday self. So just see where you've coming from and where you are now, and then you probably can be impressed with how much you've grown, right?
Yeah.
And related to that is, we highly recommend, we do this in our programs. We have clients keep a wins file, and we do this religiously ourselves as well. Like every Monday, Julie and myself, we go into our wins file and we update it, because it's a form of logging your achievements, because it's very easy to forget. And going back to compare yourself to yesterday, if you have your wins logged for years, you can read back in detail what your small wins were then. And
that's interesting.
And then you're probably going to see, like, the wins you're having now, like, you could not even have imagined, like, 4 years ago.
Yeah, it's like a personal gratitude thing, you know?
Yeah, wins file, they call it success wall, brag doc. You know, yeah. There are different names for it.
That's cool.
But it all goes back to Yeah, make sure you compare yourself more to yourself than to others, because there will be others that always will be smarter.
Or have had more time in there, especially for us late starters.
Yeah, that's also what I hit in jobs when I was saying I was not performing enough. And then one of my managers said like, but yeah, you compare yourself to people that work on this stack for 15 years. I mean, you're just here for 2 months. I mean, what are you talking about, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, two more. Yeah, I think imposter syndrome, it's actually, you can turn it into your ally because it keeps you humble and on your toes. So it also, you can use it as fuel to always keep learning. Because I think as a developer, it's so fast paced with new frameworks, with AI and whatnot, that you have to continuously learn. And I think imposter syndrome can drive that. And the last one is similar to the previous getting unstuck question, is to seek a supportive community. Because if you do this together with people, I think that can, at least have you deal with imposter syndrome better.
Or maybe have somebody to share the wins with.
Yeah. Oh, we have wins channels in our programs and in the public community as well.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, nice.
So people show. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. I have these weekly questions I like to ask everybody when they come on the show. And the first one is, what's something that you're excited about that's happening in the world of Python?
That's a great question. There's so much happening. And one thing I've not caught up with and I want to keep up with is the increasing role and power of Rust. So I don't have much time now to learn a new language, but it's you know, we had Ruff and now we have UV and we have Pydantic's performance being boosted by Rust. So I'm not saying it's everywhere, but increasingly you hear about Rust. And then I have a coach friend who is coaching on Mindset and Rust as well. And yeah, he also reminded me, you could always learn it, right? Because you have static typing and there's things in that language that will make you a better Python developer just by offsetting that, comparing how, and that's, I mean, I guess you can say the same if you would learn JavaScript or another language, just, you know, then to appreciate how Python does things. And
yeah.
So I think Rust is interesting to look at. And of course, the whole thing that AI is doing and not doing, or maybe will do.
Yeah, we didn't focus on that much as far as like using those types of tools for learning, but... I'm still interested by it, but I have lots of questions. I've brought them up on the show often and think about, I feel like the jury's still out as far as the impact of all these things and trying to make sure that it's still being steered in this positive direction for not only our industry, but like, you know, at large.
And in general.
And so I'm interested in that.
Yeah, that could be a whole another episode, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah. What's something that you want to learn next? And this doesn't have to be about programming. It could be, you know, cooking, guitar, I don't know, whatever.
That's a great question. I should have given that some thought. I'm always passionate about language learning, right? But that would be more like a refresher, because then I probably would default to a language I had been practicing before.
Sure.
Rust I mentioned, but I struggle to find time.
Sure.
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, you'd mentioned, I don't know, 3 or 4 languages early on there. Yeah. I don't know if you still dabble in them at all, or is Python the main thing?
Python is still the main thing. I also really like Unix and command line, but if you go into bash shell scripting, then I quickly go to Python because it's more readable.
If you can, yeah, sure.
So, yeah. Sorry, I don't have a clear answer. Maybe awesome. Rust and language learning, like spoken language learning, going back to that. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. How many languages do you speak? Or I guess, would you say you're fluent in?
So Dutch is my native tongue. I'm originally Dutch. And then English, I speak that the whole day with everybody. And then Spanish, I speak here at home with the family and on the streets, you know?
Yeah.
And then I was practicing French and Italian, but, you know, time.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. At least those have some related structures. You know,
yeah, it syntax, gets easier, you know. Right? With the Latin languages.
Yeah, the Romance languages.
Yeah, Romance.
Yeah, cool. So how can people, you know, what's the best way that they can follow the work that you do online?
Yeah, so we have our website on pybits.es. took the Spanish domain name for giggles back then. Not for SEO, I guess. Yeah, I really invite people to join our community. So that's on Circle. It's pybytes.circle.so. Well, we can link it.
Okay.
And if you want to follow me personally, you can do it on X or Twitter, B. Balderbos, and LinkedIn is also a good place to connect.
Great. Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Bob, it's been fantastic to talk to you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, it's so much fun. Thanks for the great questions and interview. Really enjoyed it.
All right. I'll hope to talk to you soon.
Yeah. Cheers.
I want to thank Bob Balderbos for coming on the show this week. And I want to thank you for listening to the Real Python Podcast. Make sure that you click that follow button in your podcast player. And if you see a subscribe button somewhere, remember that the Real Python Podcast is free. If you like the show, please leave us a review. You can find show notes with links to all the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.